T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Welcome to Special Edition, a weekly look at the issues in the news and the personalities shaping the stories. Special Edition is a production of Entercom Communications.
Welcome to Special Edition. I'm Paula Degnan. A major controversy this week over separating children from their families whose parents cross borders illegally. Intercom's Frank Andrews with Ira Melman. He is the media director of FAIR, Federation for American Immigration Reform. They spoke about zero tolerance.
And on the line with us right now from FAIR is Ira Melman. Ira, thanks for joining us. How's your afternoon going?
So far, so good.
Okay. The easy question to begin. Can you tell us what the heck is happening? I mean, I have a stack of about 2 inches thick here, 100 different stories, you know, and conflicting reports. This is happening. That's happening. Can you tell us what's really going on down there?
What is going on is that the administration has been limited to two options to deal with this flood of people coming across the border illegally with their children. Under a consent agreement that the Obama administration entered into, the maximum amount of time that a family with children can be detained is 20 days. And that's clearly not enough time to adjudicate any kind of claim to remain here in the United States. The other alternative is to simply release the entire family as a unit and in the hope that they will show up for their hearing. And statistics tell us that the vast majority of them will never show up. So essentially, what has happened is we've created a situation where showing up with children essentially amounted to a get-out-of-jail-free card. If you showed up with a kid, we either had to release you, or the other option, which is the administration is now taking, is detaining the adults. The adults can be detained much longer than the kids can be detained. Detaining the adults and placing the children in the custody of a relative who happens to be here in the United States, or some other guardian, or in the custody of the Department of Health and Human Services. Now, let's be clear. Both of these options are bad options, and this can be fixed anytime Congress chooses to. They could pass legislation today saying, okay, we are going to allow the detention of children and families together longer than 20 days, a reasonable amount of time that is necessary to determine whether the family has a right to enter the United States. We could solve this problem today if Congress chose to, but instead they'd rather have a political football to kick around.
So you know, I mean, there's a story on the Drudge Report, you know, that says that like 196 minutes of network coverage has been devoted to this in the past 2 days. Where do you think this story's going? I mean, what's going to happen next?
Well, the ball's now in Congress's court. There's, you know, they're going to be dealing with immigration legislation this week. This should certainly be a part of it, but it's Congress's policy to be fixed. They make the laws in this country. Under the law as it now exists, the administration has only two options. Either it's use kids to get out of jail free card and release the whole family, or separate the adults and detain them and place the children in the custody of relatives or in the Department of Homeland Human Services. So they've got to give the administration a larger menu to choose from. And the most reasonable scenario is that they say, okay, we are going to allow for the detention of families as a unit until such time as we can determine whether the family has a valid claim. And, you know, if they do, then the whole family is released into the United States. If they don't, the whole family as a unit is returned to their home country.
Now, Ira, one of the things that I said was, you know, we the immigration was a real hot topic. Then it kind of dropped off the front page. Everybody's talking about gun control and a whole bunch of other things. Then, of course, North Korea. And now, you know, then it popped up and we're going to stop the caravan from coming in. We're sending National Guard troops and all that stuff. And now we're hearing 250 young people a day coming to cross the border. And it's almost like people are saying, well, why is this started again? But it's not starting again. This has been a regular occurrence, right?
Yes, it is continuing, and we need to address this. One of the ways is to make it clear to people that you're not going to be able to use your kids as a get-out-of-jail-free card. There are other things that Congress needs to fix. If you come across as an unaccompanied minor from Canada or Mexico, we can send you right back. If you come from any other country, we have to let you in and follow a lengthy procedure to tell us why you should get to stay here in the United States. That is attracting people and unaccompanied minors to come to the United States illegally. So there are things that we need to fix to remedy these situations. We also need to start holding the countries, the governments of these countries accountable. Sovereignty comes with responsibilities. You have a responsibility to protect the interests of your own citizens. And if you're not doing that, we need to hold you accountable in terms of foreign aid, in terms of availability of loans from the international lending authorities. These are the sorts of leverages that we ought to be able to use against these governments, because, you know, it is unreasonable of them to expect that they can neglect the interests of their citizens and then have the United States or some country in Western Europe do it for them.
Now, Ira, one more question. You mentioned earlier when you began to explain what's going on down there, you talked about a consent decree or something like that. And I believe you're referring to the Flores consent decree. Right. Now, people are screaming, and Elijah Cummings on the ABC newscast said, this is 100% all created by the Trump administration. They're the devil. But the Flores consent decree was under Obama, right?
That's correct. The original decision was handed down in 1997. Then a judge, I believe it was in California, ruled that under her interpretation of that court ruling, you could not detain families for more than 20 days, and the Obama administration said, okay, we accept that. What you've been hearing is, you know, the administration does not have to do this. That's true. They could just continue to let people use their kids as get-out-of-jail-free cards. There are two bad options on the table. There need to be other viable options on the table. The reason there are not other viable options on the table is because people like Elijah Cummings would never let that go through Congress. The last thing that Elijah Cummings and some of these other folks want is the ability of the government to detain people long enough to determine whether they have a right to enter the country, and if they don't, to send them back to their home countries. They don't want people being sent back, and so they're going to refuse to allow legislation through that would change the whole nature of the debate.
Now, Ira, one last question, and based on what you just said, our first call today was from a gentleman who said, you know, how can you send them back to those countries? Death squads, squalor. How do we send them back? I mean, if they've come here to get out of, you know, a sewer, what do we do? Do we just put them on a bus and send them back into that mess?
Well, look, I mean, we have to face reality, and the reality is that there are a growing number of failed societies, not just in Central America, but around the world. And, you know, the United States and a handful of Western European countries cannot be expected to indefinitely deal with the human fallout from the failure of these countries to provide the basics that their own citizens need, to provide safety, to confront the gangs. These are things that they need to do. If they're failing, they cannot expect that the United States is just going to endlessly clean up their messes. They have to be forced into a situation where they need to do what they need to do. And until we're prepared to put the pressure on them, that's not going to happen.
Ira, thanks for talking to us. Federation for American Immigration Reform, I'm grateful for your time.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
In this world of men and women, there are some similarities and some differences. When it comes to the differences, you may remember the book authored by John Gray, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. He co-authored the book that Intercom's Kyle Mack talks about today, The Boy Crisis, with psychologist Dr. Warren Farrell. In this particular book, they're looking at raising boys.
Dr. Warren Farrell, author of The Boy Crisis, thank you so much for coming on today. I've read through some of the things that you sent me here, and I get the idea. But for our audience who has no idea who you are or what's going on, first, what kind of doctor are you?
I have a PhD.
Okay, and what do you, I guess my question, like, what do you specialize in?
For the last 50 years or so, I have specialized in male-female relations. I just keep it to those two things. I'm engaged in the hopeless activity of trying to get men and women to understand each other.
Oh, boy. So you've been to...
It's at least full-time employment.
Yeah, right? You've been to Venus and Mars, I take it.
Exactly, right.
All right, great. So your book, The Boy Crisis, what's this all about?
I and John Gray, you said Venus and Mars, and John Gray obviously is the author of the book Men Are from Mars, Women Are from Venus, and he's the co-author of The Boy Crisis. And so I started this looking at this when one of my past books, a book called The Myth of Male Power, was translated into other languages, and I started traveling around the country, the world, and hearing from one country after the other that, you know, our girls are actually doing pretty well, but, you know, my son is having a lot of problems. And so I started to look into that and found that in the 60 largest developed nations, our boys were falling behind girls in every single academic subject. And so I started asking myself, what is there about developed nations that is making this happen? And I found that it was happening with two groups of people, boys and girls who were children of divorce, who, when they got divorced, had very minimal or no father involvement, and boys and girls who were the sons and daughters of mothers who were single moms who never had a father involved or had a father involved, but the father was involved for a few years, and then she was never married to begin with, and that lack of bond created a disconnect between the father and the mother, and the children were basically left without a father. And so I started looking at that more closely and started asking myself, well, what is it, you know, what exactly is the damage that is done when there isn't a lot of father involvement? And was able to identify and document more than 70 different areas, ways that children suffer from being much more likely to be depressed, to being more likely to commit suicide, to being more likely to drop out of school, to being more likely to be delinquents, to commit crimes, and you know, join ISIS. And it was really just astonishing. More likely to rape out of anger. Every nightmare that a parent has was so much more likely to happen when a child didn't have a significant amount of father involvement. And so then I began to investigate and ask why that was the case, and, you know, what was there about what dads do that's different from what moms do that allow them to be so much more effective as parents when the two parents work together, as opposed to one being out of the picture.
Okay, and then to your point, my question is, it's the boy crisis, but let's say you have maybe a daughter with, you know, a fatherless family or something like that. Are girls affected the same way?
They are affected the same way, some different ways, but not to the degree that our sons are affected. So, for example, even the Department of Housing and Urban Development was very concerned about people being involved in poor areas and feeling that that was a huge detriment to the poverty, and the poor school systems were a huge detriment to the children. So they took 17,000 families and they subsidized them to move to better neighborhoods with better schools. The girls did significantly better. The boys did worse. They were so depressed about losing their old friends, and they didn't have this, as good emotional skills to develop new friends, and so they went downhill. The girls went uphill, and this is sort of a metaphor. In just pure scientific terms, this is really amazing. What I'm going to be saying here now is telomeres, which are the parts of your cells that if they don't reproduce well, the telomeres don't reproduce well, genes that are the cure for cancer or the cure for heart disease do not get reproduced. So the shorter your telomeres, the shorter your life expectancy is by the age of 9. Well, by the age of 9, children who have minimal or no father involvement have 14% shorter telomeres, meaning predicting a 14% shorter life expectancy. But there's a male-female difference. The male telomeres, the boy's telomeres at the age of 9, are 40% shorter than the girl's telomeres are at the age of 9, giving you some amazing insight into how the impact of a lack of father involvement is on both girls and boys, but the greater impact that it is on boys. Because, and just common sense wise, a girl without father involvement still has her mother as a role model as to how to be a female, whereas the boy without father involvement does not have that role model. So both hurt significantly. Girls hurt particularly in the area of their relationships with boys. They're far more likely to have sex much more quickly in order, because they don't have enough nuanced understanding of how to be able to keep a boy, except to know to be able to be sexual with him. Or conversely, they're so afraid of connection with boys that they can't be either involved intimacy-wise in terms of psychological intimacy, and they also can't be involved sexually. And so girls who don't have father involvement tend to err on both extremes, being very sexual too quickly or not sexual or intimate soon enough because they're uncomfortable and they don't know enough about boys to know how to create a good connection.
So biologically, a full family is really important, I guess, to boys and girls. I mean, I guess the big question I had, reading through this, and you speak about marriage and keeping the family together and just working things out. I think one of the things you said here was about it's not people don't get divorced over bills and things like that. They get divorced because they don't talk to each other about these things.
Yes, exactly. People do not get divorced over money and sex and things like that. They get divorced over their inability to communicate about money and sex. And so if we really want to change the boy crisis, and one of the things that would be really helpful is to start communication classes in first, second, and third grade, and to also train parents to know how to communicate. And the single biggest Achilles heel of all human beings is our inability to handle personal criticism from our loved ones without becoming defensive, especially if that personal criticism is given badly. And almost always anyone thinks that any criticism given by their loved one is given badly. So we need to, really focus on being able to alter our psychological receptivity to criticism. And that's I teach courses in that all around the country, and it's extremely hard to do. It takes me a good 10, 12 hours of workshop work with couples to teach them how to alter their way of being able to hear criticism. But if you can't hear, if you aren't able to communicate about the tough problems between the two of you, then the father thinks that he has the best answer to the problem, the mother thinks she has the best answer, and the two of them think that they're bad parents because the father feels the mother, let's say, is overprotective, and the mother feels that the father is roughhousing, and she feels like when he's roughhousing, she just has one more child to monitor, and the father doesn't know that when he roughhouses, he doesn't do his homework, he doesn't read books, like whether it's The Boy Crisis or any other book on parenting. He doesn't read those books and find out what is there about roughhousing that leads my children to know when it goes too far, when it doesn't, what's the difference between being assertive and being aggressive, and what is the... He doesn't explain to mom that when I roughhouse with a child, that creates a bond, and that bond I'm able to use as leverage to enforce boundaries. I'm able to say, no more roughhousing until you finish all your homework and you brush your teeth and get everything ready for bed and do your chores. And the child is so desirous of getting back and roughhousing again and having or playing or having daddy read a nice story to him before bedtime that she or he focuses on the work that they need to do in order to get what they want, the roughhousing. And that teaches the child postpone gratification, to do what you need to do before you get what you want. And without postpone gratification is the single biggest ingredient to becoming successful. Without postpone gratification, the child that goes into school doesn't do his homework well because they're distracted by text or distracted by a new video game opportunity. And then they start feeling ashamed of themselves because they don't do their work well. They're not standing out as well as other students. That shame begins to lead to withdrawal into things like video games or porn, and the child starts to feel more and more depressed and negative about himself and his ability to have real-life relationships.
So this is a cycle that, it could start basically with the parents communicating to each other. Would you say, is it more important to have constructive criticism, or is it more important to be able to take criticism?
That's a really good question. I'd say the biggest Achilles heel is our inability to handle personal criticism. Criticism is a very tricky thing. The person giving criticism almost never sees herself or himself as criticizing. They see themselves as making a suggestion to improve the situation or the relationship. Any person hearing any suggestion for a change in attitude or a change in behavior perceives herself or himself as being criticized. And so, people will often say, gee, you're always criticizing me. And the other person says, what do you mean? I'm not criticizing you at all. I'm just making a suggestion for improvement. But the person who receives those suggestions, you come home from shopping and you get 40 different items, and somebody says to you, your partner says to you, oh, you should have gotten us a quart of milk rather than the half gallon. We can't fit the half gallon in the refrigerator so easily. And so the person coming home feels like, gee, and now the person making that suggestion feels they're just making a good suggestion for a more efficient refrigerator. The other person feels I've gotten 40 items. The only one that you make any comment about is the one that's the wrong one. That doesn't feel like a real great incentive to do more shopping.
Oh, I've actually been there. She got a half gallon of milk, and I was like, why don't you just get a gallon? And it went downhill from there, kind of like you're saying.
Yeah, you
know? And I didn't mean anything by it. It was just like, I don't want to have to go out and buy another half gallon of milk later. That was it. What I mean? It's not, and maybe this is a subject for a new book for you, but politically, I see a lot of that. People, when they talk about, and we don't even have to talk about this if you don't want to, but the president, when people bring him up, you have one side that would say, like, it's almost like they're criticizing, but they think that they're trying to make a way for it to be better. But then you have the other side that hears, like, the criticism, and that's all they hear. So they think that you're just thinking negatively. But somewhere in the middle, is people with good intentions. It's just that we kind of, I feel like both sides are deaf to that.
Absolutely, and we certainly see that deafness in this culture today. That probably as divided as it's been for maybe since the Civil War, and this has really been the inability to hear people is very natural. It's biologically natural. Falling in love is biologically natural. Sustaining love is biologically unnatural, and one of the ways that it's unnatural is that when we make suggestions for improvement, it's biologically natural to interpret those as criticism. And that's because, historically speaking and biologically speaking, if you had a kinship network or a tribe and you heard criticism about yourself from another tribe, if you wanted to survive, you perceived that that might be an enemy, so you got up your defenses or you killed the criticizer before the criticizer killed you. And that was a method of survival. But today, if your partner makes a suggestion and you kill your partner before your partner kills kills you because you feel that that suggestion is a criticism that's going to emotionally kill you, then that becomes a way of not allowing your partner to feel safe for sharing what she or he needs to share in order to make a better relationship. And so so because it's biologically unnatural, the training that I do in my workshops is to get people to only share their major concerns during a short period of time during the week. The rest of the week is a conflict-free zone. And then during that short period of time, they focus on hearing what their partner needs to say. And but before they do that, they alter their psychological state by doing a series of meditations that connect them to their partner's love. And so that allows their partner to, the person receiving the criticism, to hear it much more openly. But that type of unnatural work needs to be done in order to do something that is, it's biologically natural to become defensive. It just is not constructive. But anyway, all of those things, the lack of that good communication leads to the divorces, and the divorces lead to the lack of father involvement. And so a huge amount needs to be done to compensate for that. The schools need to be getting more fathers and more men involved as teachers. We need to be getting more vocational education in schools and more recess in schools. So there's so much that needs to be done because when children go from a mother-only family to a female-dominated school system with a feminization of education, that combination doesn't leave the male with any type of support system as to how to channel his testosterone constructively. And when boys don't learn to channel their testosterone constructively, they tend to channel it destructively. So hence, almost every member of ISIS is a child without significant father involvement. And almost all your school shooters and your mass shooters, they're highly likely to have a significant lack of father involvement.
Yeah, I see here. You list a lot of the shootings where people are fatherless. But one of the questions I had reading through all this, and someone actually texts in and they mention same-sex couples. Did you do any research, or do you know anything about two father households or two mother households and how that affects the child?
We're still in the nascent stages of research on that. A lot of research says gay parents do really well. A lot of research says gay parents do not do really well. And when you look at the research, usually it's from a gay advocacy group where they find that the parents do really well, and from some anti-gay marriage group that you find the other data. But we don't have enough long-term data. What we do know is that, as a rule, parents that that go against the norm, that highly self-select each other, whether they're single fathers, for example, the children do extremely well with single fathers. When the single father is married and the mother is, when I said single fathers, I should have said, when fathers bring up children predominantly, the children do well as long as they're married and the mother stays connected to the children, which mothers almost always do. In gay families, we don't have good long-term data because there haven't been a lot of stable gay families that have raised children that have grown up to be adults that we've been able to see the pattern of and where we have had large enough numbers to control for socioeconomic variables and other things that might cause a difference. However, what we do know is that in all populations where there are people who are self-selected, like gay parents are self-selected, they're highly motivated, and so they're usually going to be very focused on their children and very conscious of their parenting. And so there's a good chance that that the children will probably have a more positive experience because of that self-selection and high motivation.
That's so interesting. And, the way I tied this into the show today is I was doing a show about graduating and advice for graduates and what happens after, school or college or whatever. How does this, and maybe you already kind of hit on it, how does this particular, the boy crisis, affect graduation rates and success later on in life?
Yes, if you have a if you're a graduate, then the chances are fairly good that you're already on your way. If you're selecting a partner, and I'd say here are some things to watch out for. Ask yourself, what is my personality? Am I a personality who, when I get married, I want to be, if I'm a guy, I want to be a full-time dad? And if I do want to be a full-time dad, you've got to make sure that if you, the woman that you select is a woman who can really respect a full-time father, and because, and she would maybe have an aspiration to be what she would call a have-it-all woman, a woman who has a powerful career, but wants to have a good marriage and wants to have children that are well-raised. Well, she can do that, but she can do that only if you, as a guy, are desirous of being what I call a father warrior, that is a father who really wants to overcome the barriers of discrimination that the society has against a full-time father and be involved as a full-time father. You probably read in the Boy Crisis book my story with, you know, my John Lennon coming up to me and saying that he joined a men's group that I formed, and that men's group led him to making a decision to be fully involved with his new son Sean, and that led to him taking off work for 5 years to be a full-time dad, and I asked him, you know, was that a good decision for you at this point in time? Sean was only 2 years old, and he said, it was the best decision of my life. And so, you know, very powerful people, men with very good careers, when they do put their time into their children, they find it is the most rewarding experience that they've ever had. And so the graduate from high school who's a male needs to ask himself that question: is that what I want to do? Does that tap into my personality? But if I do, if that does, there are many women who won't respect me if I don't earn as much money as they do, and they won't even marry me or want to have children with me. So you've got to select the right woman for that. And I sort of talk in the Boy Crisis book about how to go about selecting the right woman for that. And conversely, with a woman, you've got to ask yourself the question: you know, if I, am I a woman who wants to be home full time with the children? That's one thing. But if you're a woman who wants to break a glass ceiling and do very well in your career, yet you also want to be married and have children and have them raised well, the solution is not to be a single mom. That puts a huge amount of stress on you. The children are far more likely to grow up being disobedient, non-productive, talking back. You'll be more likely to feel overwhelmed and stressed and juggled, and you will not have the satisfaction, chances are, of well-raised children. Now, there are mothers, single mothers work extremely hard, probably harder than almost any other subpopulation group, and some children of single mothers do very well, but that's the exception rather than the rule, and you're taking a big risk.
So there's a lot going on. It's almost like we have science and biology, and all these things are competing. I'm going to leave it there because I have to take a break. But if everybody wants to get your book or maybe your seminar, how can we contact you or find these things?
Yes, for the Boy Crisis book, just go on Amazon. They really have a very good price for it there. Or if you're interested in learning more about the couples communication that I was talking about, go on warrenferrell.com. It's Warren, Ferrell is F as in Frank, Arrell, warrenferrell.com.
Perfect. Well, Dr. Warren Ferrell, author of The Boy Crisis, thank you so much for coming on today.
It's a real pleasure. It's nice to connect with you.
No, thanks.
Big Sisters of the Bridge, located on East Northampton Street in Wilkes-Barre, is currently involved in a 100 Matches in 100 Days campaign. They currently have more than 300 children on their waiting list. They're hoping to secure 100 new Big Brother, Big Sister matches by August 30th. Intercom's Rocky and Lissa caught up with one woman who heard about the campaign and began the process to look for her little match. They now introduce us to Suzanne, who's having all kinds of fun with her new little Harley.
All right, my friends at Big Brothers Big Sisters of the Bridge this summer have issued a challenge, 100 matches in 100 days. And throughout the summer, we're trying to motivate you to volunteer and become a big. And we have in studio a relatively new big. Her name is Suzanne. Welcome
Suzanne.
To the Big Brother
so
Big
much.
Sister program.
Thank you.
And you've been matched up with a beautiful 10-year-old girl.
I have an extraordinary little sister. Her name is Harley. And yes, she's 10 years old. Harley and I are just remarkable together. It took about a year, actually, to get this match to happen. When Big Brothers Big Sisters, you know, you go through your interview process and sure. they do your background checks, et cetera, they really want to make sure that you have the best possible match that they could find. So mm-hmm. it's not like the next kid that comes along or the next
right.
big that comes along. They're very thorough and they're very careful about making the match. So Miss Harley waited for about a year, and then I came into her life last October.
And you guys just gelled right away.
Oh, my God. Yes.
What a blessing.
Yeah, we really did. We really gelled. She's an awesome kid, and we just do a lot of cool things together and a lot of the same interests, a lot of the same very dry humor, you know.
That's good.
And
yeah,
what attracted cool. you to Big Brothers Big Sisters?
I was at a point in my life where I had more free time. Mm-hmm. I do have a 26-year-old son, so it kind of was empty nest syndrome. But on the other hand, I kind of feel like I have a life that I take a lot of pleasure in sharing it with people, especially people who I love. And I thought if I could expose and I could partner with somebody younger who maybe could use a little bit of a mentor
right.
or a buddy or a big sister or whatever. So I looked at a few different options that were out there, made some phone calls, and decided that Big Brothers Big Sisters was the best thing for me.
Awesome. And don't you find it's a two-way street where you're having a big impact on your little and vice versa, they're changing your life.
Oh, my gosh.
Well.
There's absolutely, yeah. there's no doubt. I think about her. I mean, you know, like mm-hmm. I'm at work, I'm doing this, I'm doing whatever. And I think about what she's doing or I'm making plans for the next time I'm going
just
to
like
see
family.
Her.
Just like family.
And you know what? And that's what it is. Like last night, Harley came over for dinner and my mom was over.
I love
you
it.
You know what I mean? So it's just like we kind of grilled and just chilled on my deck. And that was very nice.
Well, she's lucky to have you, too. You're a strong, cool chick.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody could look up to. Honestly, you're both blessed.
Thank you.
That's a good match.
So, again, in just a couple of hours every month, and you can really make a difference in a young person's life, boy or girl. If you're interested, you need info, bbbsnepa.org. That's their website. And just like Suzanne, this is such a rewarding experience.
It really
is.
It's a tremendous rewarding experience. And, you know, if you're at a point in your life where you can pay it forward a little bit,
mm-hmm.
Just exposing children to different things in life and showing them that there's other opportunities, helping with confidence, I mean, you really could make a serious impact. And I know that Big Brothers Big Sisters is really looking for a lot of guys, a lot
mm-hmm.
of men who
yep.
could also help with the littles who happen to be boys. That's huge, too.
We've just begun 100 matches
yeah.
in 100 days. Suzanne, thanks for coming in and sharing your story.
Oh,
let's take a photo
so
like
much.
Together, and I'll put all the info on our Facebook and on our Twitter so it's easy for
awesome.
People if they'd like to
awesome,
look into
awesome.
It.
Awesome, awesome. Thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Suzanne also tells Rocky and Lissa, Harley has been helping volunteer at Hillside Farms. Her little is going to do something she's never done before. Harley is looking forward to showing a calf at the upcoming Luzerne County Fair. If you would like to find out more about the 100 Matches in 100 Days campaign, now underway through August 30th, there are several ways to get information. You can give them a call at 1-800-955-4376 or 570-824-7856. You can check out Big Brothers Big Sisters of the Bridge on Facebook or on the web at bbbsnepa.com. And before we wrap up Special Edition today, another reminder about the Breathe Deep Longevity Walk that's coming to Kirby Park in Wilkes-Barre Sunday, June 24th. Pauline Makowski is the local woman who spearheaded bringing the walk to northeastern Pennsylvania.
I chose to begin the walk locally in northeastern Pennsylvania. My husband died of stage 4 lung cancer in June of 2009. My husband was treated with chemotherapy for 16 months from the time he was diagnosed to his passing. And it's very debilitating disease. And as you know, chemotherapy is just very debilitating as well. But he fought very, very hard. And unfortunately, with stage 4 lung cancer, there's usually not a good outcome. But unfortunately, with lung cancer right now, our early detection screening and tests, that's what part of the research is being done to find a test for early detection. The early stages of lung cancer, there really aren't any symptoms. And most people that are diagnosed with stage 1 or stage 2, it was by accident that they were diagnosed. And it's usually stage 4 is where you start getting symptoms of something being wrong. So longevity's goal, of course, is to, with the research, is to find early detection tests and, of course, immune therapy and new therapies for lung cancer. There are a few new drugs out there, immunotherapy, and they're showing, again, they're pinpointed to a particular type of lung cancer. There are different types. So right now, it's only one particular type of lung cancer that's being treated with the immunotherapy. But it's certainly in the right direction that they're going to continue to find other therapies for it. Longevity has 118 research projects in 58 institutions in 23 states across the country. You know, lung cancer is just, it kills more people yearly than all the three other top cancers. It's just very, very scary, actually. And only 6% of government funding for lung cancer research. So we need a foundation like Longevity to be out there doing research to try and find answers.
Pauline Makowski brought the Longevity Breathe Deep Walk to Northeastern Pennsylvania, and she says longevity.org has much more to do with lung cancer than raising money for research and making people aware. They're also there to help those who have been affected along with their loved ones.
They have the largest online support group in the country for lung cancer, whether it be a caregiver, the patients, or any other family members. There's help out there for them. There's a peer-to-peer where Longevity will team up a patient with another cancer survivor. So, you know, they could talk to people daily if they need to.
And here's something you might not be aware of. As Pauline tells us, you don't have to be a smoker to get lung cancer.
Oh, absolutely not. And the sad part is that there's a stigma that is out there about, you know, lung cancer being a smoker's disease. And we've got to dispel that, because 65% of the diagnosed people never smoked or quit smoking. 65%. So it's not a smoker's disease. And like I said, we really need to remind people of that.
It's a family fun activity for a great cause at Kirby Park in Wilkes-Barre, Sunday, June 24th.
Our registration and check-in begins at 9 a.m. We have a 10 a.m. program, and the walk fun run begins at 10:30. And it's a really very scenic walk. It goes across the Market Street Bridge, and they walk down along the Riverwalk and then back over and walk along the levee in Kirby Park. And it is a true 5K walk fun run.
Pauline Makowski joining us today on Special Edition to tell us about the Longevity Breathe Deep 5K Fun Walk and Run, which will be happening at Kirby Park in Wilkes-Barre. The reason Pauline was spearheading the walk by bringing it to Northeast Pennsylvania, in memory of her husband, Alan.
He was, I considered him a Renaissance man. He hunted, he fished, very outgoing, involved with the community, played music, played the trumpet. He was just an all-around family guy, just a really, really good man.
Remember, if you can't make it to the walk, you can always make donations and find out more information at longevity.org. If you can make it, Intercom Communications will be taking part this year in memory of our colleague who lost his battle with lung cancer 1 year ago, L.A. Tyrone. A bare-knuckle boxing event took place earlier this month in Cheyenne, Wyoming, and the Squared Circle Boxing Ring was created right here in northeastern Pennsylvania. Gary Grant Jr. at Grant's Martial Arts put it together, brought it there, and now it's here on display.
I mean, the ring itself is patent pending, the way it was built. The Squared Circle is trademarked, so you're not going to see any other sport, any other type of boxing, MMA, kickboxing, taking place in something like this. If you see the Squared Circle on TV, you're watching the Bare Knuckle Fighting Championships. My gym is Grant's Martial Arts in Plymouth. We actually built this, we were calling it the Squared Circle, because it's a square platform with a circular enclosure up top. And we built it in the basement of Grant's Martial Arts, and it's on display there now. The actual promoters, Dave Feldman and Dave Feldman Jr., they're from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and I do a lot of cage rental and boxing ring rental for fights, and I met them at a promotion, and we actually contracted with them to build the actual ring that the Bare Knuckle Fighting Championship was taking place in. So we're not actually doing the Bare Knuckle Fights here in Pennsylvania, but there's a strong local connection here. And what they wanted was a circular boxing ring that was in a perfect circle, a 22-foot circle. So we built that here in Plymouth, PA, and it's really the first of its kind. And we shipped it out to Cheyenne, Wyoming for June 2nd for the fight. We flew out behind it and put it together and assembled it. And it was a wonderful night of fights, probably the greatest night of fights I've ever been involved with. And then we brought it back, and it's in Plymouth, and my gym in Plymouth right now set up and showing them what we got. This is a really neat piece. Well, the Squared Circle first, I mean, when you look at it, it is a huge 28-foot platform, and then it is a 22-foot circle on the top. And originally, boxing took place in, you know, what they called a ring. And a ring was just either a ring of people or a ring of dirt they drew on the ground.
Oh,
and, yeah. And then when they started... when they started enclosing it in, with ropes or wood or whatever they did in those days, you know, they couldn't get it to bend in a circle. So even though they call a boxing ring or even a wrestling ring a squared circle, I mean, I believe these are the first fights actually taking place in a ring that was built in a circle. So that's pretty interesting. I mean, my goal with this ring is if someday it ends up in the boxing or the Bare Knuckle Hall of Fame, because there really is the first true ring for a fight sport.
You never know where you're going to meet someone or something from northeastern Pennsylvania. From the Squared Circle Boxing Ring taking part in the event in Cheyenne, Wyoming, ending up perhaps in the Bare Knuckle Boxing Hall of Fame. Again, that's Gary Grant Jr., and it came from Grant's Martial Arts in Plymouth. The Bare Knuckle Boxing Hall of Fame that Gary spoke about is in Belfast, New York. It does have championship belts, posters, and stories about bare knuckle boxers. Of course, you can find out more about the Squared Circle Boxing Ring if you visit Grant's Martial Arts Facebook page. They'll be happy to pass along any information if you're interested.
Thanks for listening to Special Edition, a weekly look at the issues in the news and the personalities shaping the stories.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. and great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.